Of all the campus protest videos that have spun through my timeline over the last couple of weeks, there are a few that I can't get out of my head. There's one from Emory University. This professor of economics walks up to some cops who are arresting the student. She's trying to question what they're doing, but she ends up pinned to the ground in zip ties. There's another video that's quite sweet. It shows students in an encampment holding a Passover Seder together, calmly praying, sharing a meal. And then there's this video that was shot at night up at Columbia.
Repeat after me!
We have me!
We have Zionists!
Who have entered the camp!
In it, students form a human chain. They physically push counter-protesters out of their space.
Please join me in this chain!
It's impossible to get a full picture of what's going on these campuses just from viral videos. But I've watched this Columbia tape again and again. There's something cinematic about it. The slow march forward. It builds tension.
Excuse me, do you see what you guys are doing to us?
We are going
to slowly. You see how hostile this is? And you're asking me not to record?
But it also builds dread. Dread that people are literally being pushed out of a conversation, marginalized, that Jewish students are under threat.
Walk and take a step forward.
Yeah, I absolutely feel threatened right now.
So that we can.
I wanted to talk about videos like this, so I called up a friend of the show, Peter Beinart. He's the editor-at-large at Jewish Currents. I started by asking, had he seen this recording?
Yes, I have seen it, and I totally understand why that video feels menacing.
Peter lives in New York. He's Jewish. He also supports the goals of many of these protesters, has been texting back and forth with them, actually.
Part of what I think is happening here is the term Zionist, what they were saying, they were saying there's Zionists who have come onto the encampment.
Yeah, literally, like that's, it was like roll call. There are Zionists here. Everybody join up.
Yes. It's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist, to say you don't want a state that favors Jews over Palestinians. But the challenge is that in an environment in America where many, many Jews, majority of Jews, identify themselves as Zionists, sometimes I worry that people are using the term Zionist in a way that could be being applied to Jews more generally.
In fact, after Peter and I spoke, a different video of one of the campus protesters went viral. It's the same person who led that call and response to push pro-Israel students off Columbia's College Green. In this newly found video, the student says, "Zionists don't deserve to live." The student apologized for their words. They said this statement doesn't even represent their current views. But what they said, it was a lot. Peter sees these videos flying back and forth, and he wants all of us to take a deep breath. Consider the long view.
I mean, if you think about the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, there were people, you know, chanting, "Give peace a chance." There were also people holding flags, North Vietnamese flags, or chanting, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF," meaning the North Vietnamese Marxist government is going to win. So there was a really wide spectrum of those people. Some of those people I would have felt very comfortable with, some of them really uncomfortable with. I think the fact that we see this ideological diversity and people expressing themselves in really different ways, some in ways that I find quite inspiring and some ways that I think are really ugly and anti-Semitic, is not actually really surprising in a movement like this, which is attracting a lot of different people.
Yeah, and I guess a key difference between these protests and what happened with Vietnam, there's a very large population of Jews in America, people who feel very close to Israel.
Yes, absolutely. And that makes these conversations all the more difficult.
Today on the show, Peter and I are going to have this difficult conversation about anti-Semitism and protest together. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. It's easy to start a quote. You'll be able to choose the best option for you. It's fast. Now that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you. It is just one of many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Pricing coverage match limited by state law. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Peter Beinart says, looking at the campus protests that are breaking out around the country can be a disorienting experience for someone who's Jewish. The State of Israel, after all, was created as a post-Holocaust safe space for a group of people who'd been through tremendous trauma. Seeing so many young people openly question Israel and its motivations can feel like a threat. Some Jewish leaders have been fanning this fear. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has alleged that campus protests are pro-Hamas. And the head of the Anti-Defamation League has called out student organizers like Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace directly.
Iran has their military proxies like Hezbollah, and Iran has their campus proxies like these groups like SJP and JVP. That, I mean, look at them. I mean, this is literally.
But Peter notes a lot of the students participating in the protests are Jewish themselves. And that ties into a huge generational shift that's going on inside the Jewish community.
American Jews have been voting for the Democratic Party since Franklin Roosevelt, really unlike any other mostly white ethnic group. But certainly since 1967, American Jews have also been very, very deeply invested in the existence of the State of Israel and Zionism as the ideology of this state, with the idea that in a post-Holocaust world, having a Jewish state keeps Jews safe, not just in Israel, but keeps Jews safe potentially all around the world. The challenge is that this principle that American Jews support in the United States of equality under the law is really quite fundamentally different than the principle that Israel is based on as a Jewish state. What a Jewish state means is that Jews run things. And Israel is a territory that controls millions of Palestinians, a country that controls millions of Palestinians who aren't even citizens in the country in which they live.
So there's this contradiction between two principles, a contradiction Peter says American Jews haven't been forced to grapple with because for many decades, Palestinian voices mostly weren't listened to.
But I think in recent years, with social media and other things, Palestinian voices, especially among young progressives, have started to gain more traction. And that has led a lot of progressives to say, essentially to American Jews, hey, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to say you're a Zionist, we're going to say that we don't think you're genuinely a liberal or genuinely a progressive because we don't think Zionism actually respects those basic principles. And that shift has been really, really unnerving, I think, for a lot of American Jews who went to college at a time when they could proudly be in all the liberal organizations, the progressive organizations, the environmental, and, you know, pro-choice, whatever, and also be supporters of Israel. And now they find that their kids actually are having a lot more difficulty doing that. And also that some of those kids themselves are now, because of this contradiction, are moving away from Zionism themselves.
You know, you once called yourself a Zionist, right?
Indeed, I still do, but of a very unusual sort. I would identify myself as a Zionist who does not believe in a Jewish state. So a lot of people might listen to that and say, what do you mean? That's what Zionism is. A Zionist believes in a Jewish state. Actually, there were a whole series of other ideas about Zionism before Israel's creation. What Zionism meant was that there would be a thriving Jewish culture in Israel and Palestine, but not a state that favored Jews over Palestinians. So I find myself really attracted to that tradition because it's a way of talking about the potential flourishing of Jewish life and culture in Israel-Palestine without Jewish supremacy. But that's not the way that many other people, of course, use the term Zionist.
I wonder how the Peter of like 10 or 20 years ago would have seen the protests on campus that are happening right now. Would he have seen them very differently?
I think that I probably would have seen them more negatively than I do now. Again, it's not to say that I don't have criticisms of them now, but I think I'm one of those Jewish people, like those young people who are on campus today, some of them, who's has gone through a process of transformation. And that process of transformation has been because of listening to Palestinians. I don't feel any less passionately committed to Jewish tradition and to the Jewish people than I did before. But I've been forced over a long period of time to reckon, I think, begin to reckon with some really painful realities about what a Jewish state, or to be more provocative, a Jewish supremacist state, what that means for people who are not Jewish. And I think that it took me a long time to grapple with some of those things. But what's happening among younger American Jews, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, is that that's actually happening much faster. It's often happening even in the course of a year or two. They really rethink things that they were taught when they were growing up. And so it changes their perspective when they see protests like this.
I wonder whose job you think it is to make Jewish community members feel safe on campus or wherever protests are occurring. Like, do you think protesters themselves have some responsibility to make clear that Jewish people are not their target?
I think it is really fundamentally incumbent on the protest movements to make a clear distinction between Jews on the one hand and Israel on the other, which is a state, or Zionism, which people see as the ideology of that state. Just like it would be fundamentally incumbent on someone who was criticizing the government of China to make it clear that that has nothing to do with their views of, let's say, Chinese Americans. I do think there are a lot of people, I think most people, certainly the people I know who are involved in these movements, do try to do that. And if they weren't doing somewhat of a decent job of it, there wouldn't be able to be so many Jews in this movement. And there are a lot of Jews. But of course, there are other people who glob onto this as well, who participate, who don't make that distinction. And it's hard to police these movements. I think universities do have an obligation to make sure that Jews, like anybody, are safe from physical attack and also safe from genuine discrimination. But there's a different kind of work that has to be done, which is the dealing with the intellectual, often the very intense intellectual discomfort of hearing a country, Israel, and an ideology, this political Zionism, the ideology of the state that you have been raised to love, and hearing people be very, very harshly critical of it. And I think that work is the work of that the Jewish community itself should be doing, that Jewish institutions themselves, when we raise kids, should be exposing them to Palestinian voices so they can understand why Palestinians and others might see Israel in a really, really different way.
I wonder if there are words you hear protesters throwing around that you kind of want to ban. Like, I'm thinking a lot of protesters talk about being anti-colonialist, but you've spoken about how in other movements, that can be an exclusionary term. It implies that you don't want to work together for a shared future?
Well, I don't want to ban phrases. I don't think that's the right thing to do. And I don't actually have a problem with anti-colonial. I mean, because you can have an anti-colonial movement like the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, in which the idea is that the vision is for equality, not for the people, you know, not for one group of people to have to leave. I think there's some slogans that are more productive than others if one wants to grow the movement. Globalize the Intifada, to me, is not a productive slogan.
From New York to Palestine, globalize the Intifada.
I recognize that Intifada is not an anti-Jewish word. It's just the Arabic word for uprising. So the Arab Spring uprisings were also called intifadas against Arab governments. I also recognize that the first Palestinian intifada of the late 1980s was largely nonviolent. But the term intifada can mean a nonviolent uprising, or it can mean a violent uprising, including against civilians. And in the wake of October 7th, which was a violent uprising against civilians, which targeted civilians, it seems to me it would be better to be clear about the kind of resistance that one supports.
I wonder how pro-Israel protests fit into a vision of safety for people on campus. I'm thinking about this incident that got a lot of attention over the last couple of weeks. A business school professor named Shai Davidi from Columbia, he tried to lead some pro-Israel people onto campus to counter-protest the encampment. He was stopped because I think the university basically decided that if he came in, something bad could happen. They had de-escalation experts there who were like, no, let's not have this. But that is silencing him. Like, I can see both sides here. I can see how people think, how a person would think, I need my voice to be heard, and you are silencing me and keeping me from making my views known. And I can see how there's a safety decision here, you know?
Right. I think as a general principle, it's really important that pro-Israel students have the right to have protests and speak and be able to do it so safely, just like it's really important that pro-Palestinian students have that right. Now, again, in certain circumstances, I can understand that, you know, if there's a threat of physical violence between two competing protests, that one might need to try to avoid that. And so maybe it means that one group is doing their protest at one time and another group is doing the protest at another time. But what I would really like to see is for people of a very wide ideological perspective from left and right to come together behind the principle of free speech on college campus, even free speech that some people might find offensive. Because one of the things that really worries me is that there has been some tendency on the left going back for a number of years to essentially try to disrupt people who speak who they consider offensive, and including people who are pro-Israel, and I really disagree with that. I think you can protest a speech, but to disrupt it and not allow the person to be able to speak is fundamentally wrong. But now we have layered on top of that a threat to free speech, which I think is even greater, which is that the pressure on these university campuses to ban the pro-Palestinian organizations. And Columbia did suspend Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Force for Peace earlier this year. And then we have the potential for state coercion from members of Congress who are literally pressuring presidents of universities, saying, are you going to discipline this professor? Are you going to fire this professor? Are you going to expel these students?
It seems like escalating silencings to me.
Yes, this is really McCarthyism. I mean, when you're bringing state power into it, it was really chilling to me to watch the president of Columbia University basically say, under pressure from these right-wing Republicans, I'm going to discipline my professors because they've said things that you don't like. They may well have said things that I don't like, but a university president, to my mind, should tell members of Congress they are not going to take orders from Congress about impeding the free speech rights of their faculty and students.
After the break, why Peter thinks campus crackdowns on protest could create bigger problems. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier. And it could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, or even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
I'm Jerusalem Demsis. I'm a writer at The Atlantic. And my beat, in many ways, is to challenge the conventional wisdom. I've written about how the problem with local democracy might just be too much voting, about how some environmental laws actually squash green energy development, and about how maybe the big demographic question of the day isn't overpopulation, but underpopulation. My new show is called Good on Paper. It questions what we really know about popular narratives with a new guest every Tuesday. Find and follow Good on Paper from The Atlantic, wherever you get your podcasts.
Peter looks at the demonstrations we're seeing on college campuses, and he sees an attempt at ethical resistance. Protesters want to see their universities divest from Israel, stop using their endowments to support arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, which maintain ties with the Israeli Defense Forces. This kind of resistance has worked in the past. Students successfully rallied their colleges to pull money out of South Africa to protest apartheid in the 1970s and 80s. And that bolstered ethical resistance movements within South Africa itself. But when the response to these movements is to send in the cops, shut things down, Peter says, it can disrupt this potentially virtuous cycle.
This is something that I find really frustrating about a lot of the American discourse and a lot of the discourse in my own Jewish community, which is that people are rightly horrified by what happened on October 7th. And yet I find that when Palestinians and their supporters try to do other things to resist their oppression and to gain their freedom, they also, American politicians, establishment Jewish leaders, they react incredibly hostily to those things as well, without recognizing that when you shut off a path of ethical resistance, you are actually going to empower people who resist in the most unethical ways. So I think that that's one of the things that I really worry about the response here. But I also think that there's something else which is happening, which is really remarkable, which is that you have a movement in the United States and in other places based around the idea of Palestinian freedom. And it's not just a Palestinian movement. It's a movement with people from all kinds of different backgrounds, including lots and lots of Jews. I believe that that's actually more likely to be effective. And also, it's more likely to be effective in combating anti-Semitism, because it shows that actually there are many, many Jews who care deeply about Palestinian liberation, and that puts the lie to anyone who says that this is just a fight of Palestinians versus Jews.
You know, I don't want to end this conversation without talking about one more thing, which is who the people are who are signal boosting this conflict between different Jewish people right now. Like, we're talking, it's Thursday, April 25th. So far this week, Mike Johnson, the hardcore conservative Speaker of the House, he went to Columbia to encourage protesters to pack things up, and he got booed.
They have screamed at those who bear the Star of David. Enjoy your free speech.
What are these alliances between pro-Israel forces and the right-wing power structure tell you about this debate we are having and engaged with about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism?
These folks in the Republican Party, in the kind of Trump-dominated Republican Party, say they care deeply about Jewish safety. But one has to take that with more than a little bit of a grain of salt, given that they're supporting Donald Trump, who more than any president in modern history is deeply connected to a white nationalist movement that whose vision of the role of Jews in America is not one that I think makes most American Jews comfortable at all. This is a movement that really wants America to be a white Christian nation. And they're willing to essentially allow Jews to be part of that, as long as American Jews kind of take their side. I think that buying into an ethno-nationalist project for American Jews is very dangerous. And that historically, American Jews have seen our safety as in alliance with other groups of people who are struggling for equality under the law. And I think one of the things that we're seeing is a debate among American Jews about where our values and our interests lie. Do they lie with the principle of equality under the law in the United States and in Israel-Palestine? Or do they lie with ethno-nationalists, both in Israel and in the United States, which puts people in alliance with the Republican Party? And I think that's the debate that's playing out among American Jews today.
It's late April now. College classes are wrapping up. It's about to be graduation season. I feel like this moment of protest, it could just fade away with, you know, students leaving. Do you think it will?
For the time being, it may fade away, but I think there are deeper things that are happening that will reemerge in different ways. Probably at the Democratic Convention, there's going to be a lot of protest around this. And if we look at the history of these movements, let's say the Occupy movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, they start to seep from college campuses and activist circles into the political system. So I think that just as, you know, the anti-war movement was behind the nomination of George McGovern in 1972 as the first real anti-war candidate of the Cold War, we're going to see the political ripple effects of these movements as these young people get older for years to come. And it's going to change the American political debate about Israel-Palestine. That's what some people are so afraid of. But to me, actually, that's a source of hope.
You know, there are deep memories of trauma in the Jewish tradition. And I get the sense that you are able to hold those memories, but not somehow let it impact how you're seeing what's going on right now. Is that difficult for you?
Yeah, it's difficult. But I also think that sometimes American Jews, we have been taught to think about our tradition primarily as a tradition that teaches us about our trauma and our suffering. There is a state now, the state of Israel, in which Jews have legal supremacy, tremendous power over people who don't have rights. And so one of the things that I think about is, what does our Jewish tradition have to tell us, not just about how Jews experience trauma and suffering, but about how Jews wield power? And there's a lot in our texts that offers a warning about the Jewish abuse of power. I think that we don't focus on that very much, but those are texts that seem to me really, really relevant for this moment, because we are, after all, human beings. There's nothing to say that we, any more than any other human beings, can't commit terrible abuses against other people. And we need to look at what our tradition can tell us, not just about how we survive, but how we actually wield power in an ethical way. And in the midst of this war, which is killing, you know, 15,000 children in Gaza, those seem to me the parts of our tradition that we really need to think about.
You know, I think we have kids who are maybe the same age of a teenager. And so I'm thinking about him a little bit in this moment. He's being raised Jewish. And so I don't know. Like, I think some people might hear you and I talking and think like, oh, you're brushing off anti-Semitism. But I know, like, you care about anti-Semitism, and I do too, because it's very personal for both of us. What would you say to someone who levels that charge at you?
I would say, you know, I wear a kippah pretty much all of Shabbat and on Jewish holidays. You know, my children have attended Jewish day schools. I mean, we are we are fairly visible in our family as Jews in many ways. So anti-Semitism is as great a threat to us as it is to most other Jews. And it's also a part of my family history. So I would never want to do anything that contributed to putting other Jews in danger or to minimize the threats that we face. But I think where I part company with some other folks is I don't believe that we best protect ourselves by being part of a project that oppresses Palestinians. I actually think that's putting us in greater danger over the longer term. Because I think that when we inflict or support a state that inflicts so much violence on Palestinians, we create conditions of violence that threaten us as well. To me, it's not a question of not taking anti-Semitism seriously, but it's about a different vision of how one fights against anti-Semitism. And to me, it has to be fought against in solidarity with other people, in pursuit of a world where nobody experiences bigotry, where everybody is treated fairly, including Palestinians, the people who are the neighbors of Jews in Israel-Palestine.
Thank you for coming on the show. I always feel better after a conversation with you.
Oh, thank you, Mary. I really appreciate you saying that. Thanks for having me.
Peter Beinart is the editor-at-large at Jewish Currents, and he's also the author of The Beinart Notebook on Substack. It's a really great newsletter. I suggest you subscribe. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. You can go track me down on Twitter if you are still there. I'm at Mary's desk. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.